this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey, everybody, welcome back for another edition of our Y'allitics podcast. Maybe you're listening to us in the car, on the radio. Make the kids be quiet. It's spring break week for a lot of people, so we've got a good one, though.
Yeah, indeed so. And let's get right to it, because I believe our guest is joining us for a beer today. That doesn't happen all the time, but when it does, we certainly want to get right into it and crack open what we have. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah,
am I speaking out of turn here?
You're not speaking out of turn. Doug was on. Doug Lewin is with us today, president of Stoic Energy, and knows about all things renewable here in Texas, which that industry has been exploding. Doug, I think the last time you came on with us, we joined you via Zoom, and we didn't bring a beer because a lot of people don't have a beer with us on Zoom, and you had four of them on standby, we later found out.
I don't remember you had four, man. Are you serious?
I did. I did not drink them all. We were on at 9 a.m., so I didn't drink any of them. I love beer, but 9's a little too early for me. I'm reading a book about Churchill right now, and he started at 7 a.m. So,
oh, yeah.
He accomplished a lot. So,
yeah, he had some stress going on, too, though. How many do you have today?
Just one. Just one. But it's a really good one. You guys ever been out to Jester King?
No. Where is that?
Southwest Austin, like towards Dripping Spring, out on 290.
Wow, that's beautiful country.
Great brewery. And they use like local yeast. So it's a Belgian style brewery, but using the yeast local to the area. This is a lager, so good for like day drinking, but I encourage people to go out there. Their beer is phenomenal.
Is that a lager or pilsner you had there? Either way.
Both. The German style pilsner lager beer is what it says
looks
on there.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
I'll trade you mine. Wheeler, what are you drinking?
I'm doing a Four Corners Brewery. It's called the Local Buzz. It's a honey rye golden ale.
That's one of my favorite beers anywhere. I enjoy that beer. They used to have
Of a beer that I'm drinking. That's a rarity.
And surprisingly, it's not a fruity beer like that you always like.
Got honey.
But they used to, the Local Buzz. I can't remember why they changed it. Someone listening might know this, but they used to have the top was the entire thing that came off. And I think they got some new distribution thing, and they had to change it because of some local ordinance. Maybe I'm not sure what it was. I'm having the graduate, and I hope to graduate from this course today. This podcast with Doug. This is a lager with key lime. It's from Freetail Brewing Company from San Antonio, and man, it's been it's only 8:30 in the morning, and it's already been a long day. So let's hop right into it.
Key lime, though, you're having the fruity beer today, it turns out. Okay, yeah, interesting.
It's good, too, man. It's refreshing.
The tables have turned.
Yeah,
exactly.
Stick around long enough on this podcast and weird things happen. Speaking, by the way, that leads us
of weird things happening,
this.
Huh? Of weird things happening?
And tables turning. Here we are in Texas, which has been the energy powerhouse of this country for some time now. And when you think about that, Doug, of course, most people typically think of oil and gas over the years. But wind, solar, and zero carbon power has really been ramping up lately. I've been watching your X feed. We'll just call it by its name. It's Twitter, but we'll call it X. I've been watching your X feed lately, and it seems like over and over again, you're posting these just gobsmacking numbers on how much of the grid is being supplied on any given day right now by wind and solar.
Yeah, we're seeing very routinely at this point, Jason, that there, we'll hit 70 to 80% carbon free. So with carbon free, I'm, of course, including nuclear in there, but renewables in the 60 to 70% range.
Of all the power being consumed.
Yeah, I mean, so to be clear, we're talking about when the sun is up, right? So we're talking about like a particular like hour, a couple hours during the day. But still, that's obviously very significant. And even on a yearly basis, we're up over 40% now over the entire year that's carbon free. And that is trending up fast. We'll probably be 45%, maybe even 50% this year.
And this is an oil and gas state, as we all know, Doug. How big of a deal is this? Because when Jason mentioned this, that it was up to 70 to 80% wind and solar powering the grid recently, those numbers just blew me away.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of mind blowing. But I would say, Jason, I would make a little amendment to that. I would say yes, we're an oil and gas state, but I would say first and foremost, we're an energy state, right? And I think that's the way to think of it going forward. There's going to continue to be oil and gas produced in Texas for a long time to come, but it's smart, as with anything in life, to diversify, right? And to have the wind and solar that we have, the batteries coming onto the grid. We have 150,000 workers in the state on energy efficiency, working on energy efficiency. Geothermal, it will probably be something we'll see more in the future because it uses the same skills as oil and gas workers. You're talking about drilling down into the earth for heat and bringing that back up as steam. We have a nuclear workforce. So I think it's really important to think of Texas as an energy state, which includes oil and gas, but is not only oil and gas.
Let me make one more comment about oil and gas, though, Doug. It's interesting because oil and gas is actually benefiting now from the renewables that are going in, particularly in West Texas. They're actually using that for power, correct? Can you explain that to people?
Yeah, happy to. And it's a great question, right? I mean, I think this is something that's being overlooked a little bit, is that the power needs, if you think of what it takes to power the Permian Basin and all the oil and gas production out there, there's only a small fraction of that power need that is coming from the grid. A lot of it is coming from things like basically diesel generators, right? These oil and gas crews are moving around with diesel generators. Well, diesel generation in that form, right, with you know, $3, $4, $5 a gallon compared to the grid power you're getting is somewhere around 10 to 20 times more expensive. So what we're seeing is a real push by some in the oil and gas industry. And there was actually a study done by a global energy analysis firm called S&P, the Diamondback and Pioneer and Exxon, Chevron, et cetera, funded that showed what the need was to actually add oil and gas to the grid. And they think that they're going to need another 10 to 12,000 megawatts. So to put that in perspective,
wow.
Austin's peak load is about 3,500. San Antonio is about 6,000 or 7,000. So if you add up the entire Austin and San Antonio area, we're going to need to add that much in the next 8 to 10 years just to meet the demand out of the Permian Basin. That doesn't even get to the Eagle Ford Shale or the Haynesville Shale. So these are really, really eye-popping numbers. And why do they want to connect to the grid? Because there's a lot of wind and solar and it's cheaper. So it's another reason to think of Texas as an energy state, not an oil and gas state. These different types of energy all complement each other, right? And that's sort of a better way to think about it as opposed to some sort of like cage match between them.
Well, let's talk about the cage match for a moment, because that's what, you know, we hear from the oil and gas folks saying, hey, the subsidies that wind and solar get just aren't fair. And I get that to an extent. You know, you have to get the industry up and going, but maybe I won't get into that argument. Maybe there's a time to cut it off. But to think what you're saying here is that wind and solar are helping us continue to drill for oil and gas is phenomenal.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, it's wind and solar are going to not just power oil and gas. They're going to power electric vehicles, right? We're going to electrify transportation a lot. There's a lot of industrial applications that are looking to move onto the grid as well. So you look at like steel makers in the state, they're salivating to try to connect to the grid because, again, it's cheaper and you don't have all the volatility of gas. Gas is actually pretty cheap right now, but we saw only in 2022, right, prices spiked 3 to 4 times as much. So there's all that. And I will say on the subsidies, Jason, you know, it is really important to remember that oil and gas are heavily subsidized as well. So if we're going to talk about getting rid of subsidies, we've got to get, if any of your listeners are interested in this and want to go into the weeds a little bit, just Google intangible drilling costs. Nobody in the oil and gas industry wants you to think about this, because basically what it allows them to do is write off all of the costs of exploration ahead of time. I mean, it's a massive subsidy. There was a study in a peer-reviewed journal that showed that like 50 to 70% of profits are coming from these tax benefits in the tax code. So if we're gonna, you know, complain about subsidies on the one side, we've got to, and I mean, but again, that's not to denigrate oil and gas or say that tax subsidy shouldn't be there. Every form of energy is subsidized. Nuclear is subsidized probably more than any of them, right? You could look at any single one of them and they get massive subsidies.
Doug, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the all of the above approach that, you know, Texas needs, you know, all the energy that it can get these days. And we've seen, you know, that the grid has been shaky at times and it needs all of these sources. I'm looking right now at this, I guess it's a semi-new thing, these generation outages, this dashboard that the Electric Reliability Council of Texas puts up. Now you hear ERCOT all the time. That's the grid operator for anybody who's listening who's not familiar. And now they have this dashboard where you can watch all of these different plants that are out of service right now. A lot of these are planned outages. Some are forced outages. And right now we're sitting at more than 25,000 megawatts that are offline right now, which isn't unusual in this season, I guess, because a lot of these plants are getting worked on right now. How much is it helping those big, you know, gas or coal generation plants that we're really going to rely on when we get into the, you know, 100-degree stretches in the summer, that they get to sort of sit out right now and let wind and solar do more of that heavy lifting along with nuclear, and they're not being, you know, taxed during this time because so much of it's being supplied by the zero carbon end of it?
Yeah, exactly. So look, this is another reason why I think it's really important to look at this as a system and look at how these different resources complement each other. And this is a good example, right? And we've seen this not just seasonally, but we've actually seen it in individual days. So if you look back at Winter Storm Elliott or Winter Storm Heather, the two sort of bigger cold snaps we've had come through post Uri, nothing like Uri in their, you know, severity, but still very cold snaps. And we actually set a solar production record on January 16th in the middle of Heather. Literally, it was the most solar we'd ever had at a moment, over 14,000 megawatts. What does that do? That allows those plants, many of which are very old, right, 40, 50-year-old power plants, to take a little bit of time to have, you know, workers there getting those ready for the nighttime when the sun goes down and it's going to be colder again. So and you see that in a particular day or week, but you can also see it seasonally, right? This is a season where we get a lot of wind and solar production, so that does allow some of those thermal power plants, the gas and coal power plants, to go offline for a little bit. But yeah, I actually hadn't looked today or I guess in a couple of days, because I hadn't seen 25,000 on there. That's a little bit. They do need to manage that and make sure that they're you know, evening those out. 25,000 seems like a particularly high number, but that is definitely they benefit from having these other renewable resources there, so they can actually take those times for maintenance.
And to be clear, Doug, the reason we're seeing so much renewable right now is because these gas plants and coal plants, I don't know if we have any more of those left. I think a few, but these are offline for maintenance, so they can work harder this summer when it starts to get hotter and in the overnight hours, right?
Yeah, and this isn't actually new because of wind and solar. Every year throughout the history of the industry, there'd always be maintenance seasons, right? Just like you got to take your car in to get maintenance done. But obviously, a power plant is much more complicated than a car, and it needs a period of time to go offline. But we have a lot of coal. So a lot of people don't realize this. We're number one in wind and solar, number one on solar for utility scale solar. We're actually number one on coal as well, which is, in my opinion, a kind of a dubious number one, not a number one you want, because coal is obviously very highly polluting. But we actually have like 26, 27, something like that, coal plants or coal units in the state.
You know, and I misspoke a moment ago when I was talking about those outages. I was looking at yesterday, right now as we record, we're actually at 30,000 megawatts that are offline right now, either forced or planned for maintenance. So it just gives you an idea of, you know, how much of that's going on. Doug, I wanted to ask you about batteries. Everybody keeps talking about that. You know, we got wind and we got solar. They come on, you know, really strong in certain points of the day. And, you know, the thought has always been, boy, if we could just store more of this when it's not actually being, you know, used and consumed, that would be great, because then we could, you know, send that power to the grid when the wind's not blowing, when the sun's not shining. How is Texas doing as far as batteries? I saw something that we'll lead the country in new battery installations this year. Is that right?
That'll probably happen next year. It depends how much actually gets built this year, obviously. But California still is ahead of us in that particular metric, but we will likely pass California next year. It's another tremendous success story for Texas. We're up to about 6,000 megawatts. And again, to put that in perspective, right, I just said a little while ago, San Antonio is around 6,000 or 7,000. So like a San Antonio worth of battery storage, it's particularly well suited for balancing out the variability of renewables. So you look at the summertime, right? And we had how many conservation calls do we have this year? Hopefully we'll have a lot less next year because we'll have double the amount of storage. So, you know, during the day, you've got all the solar power. And during the day, we're going to see this summer, Jason, even at, you know, on the hottest days when it's 100 degrees at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, power is going to be cheap, right? Back to that point of why oil and gas likes wind and solar. You're going to see very, very low power prices in the middle of those hot, hot days. But then as the sun sets, right, it used to be just 3 or 4 years ago, we worried a lot about, well, we have outages at 4 or 5 o'clock. That was the big concern, right? Solar is basically made 4 or 5 o'clock moot. It's you could call off. In fact, they did this last summer. The conservation alerts were like 6 to 9, right?
Sure.
So, but when the sun sets and it's still hot outside, that's a perfect time for batteries to jump in, fill that hour or two gap. Right. So batteries are really well suited for today's needs. They're going to help lower costs, increase reliability, and we should be excited to get as much as we possibly can. We'll probably see a doubling this year again, like we saw doubling last year.
Doug, let me ask you real quick, when you say power being cheap, and I know
right, that's my question too. Yeah.
Oh, we're on the same page. And yet you're drinking the same beers I like now. I'm drinking the beer you like. We're asking the same question. This is getting scary and gross. I want to ask you about that whole notion of power being cheap. You're talking about the wholesale market there, because I think
correct.
People, you know, when people hear cheap or they hear, well, power went to $0 because we had so much wind and solar, they're going, well, why does it seem like my electric bill is going up and up and up? What do you mean it's cheap? Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult thing to explain because there's so many different inputs into this. But I think there's a few reasons why power prices remain high in Texas. And to be clear, our rates are actually kind of right in the middle of the 50 states. We're like right around 25th or something like that. Maybe a little worse over the last couple of years. But our bills, and it's been this way for a long time, are among the highest in the country. We're about sixth, right around like where Connecticut is. It's not, that's not a good place to be. That's a very high bill. The reason why bills are so high when rates are sort of in the middle is because we tend to have bigger houses here and it's much, much hotter here, right? So our air conditioning units are running because your bill is like two inputs, right? It's the rate times how much you use. So the lack of energy efficiency, we waste a lot of energy in Texas, right? Focusing on reducing energy waste will go a long way to bring down our bills. It looks like the PUC and ERCOT and others are starting to make some moves in that direction, and that will help a lot. That is one input. But I think the other big thing right now, Jason, is you have a market that is kind of in flux right now. There's a lot of discussion of, do we need to change the market design? And that kind of regulatory uncertainty, whenever there's uncertainty like that in a market, prices are generally going to go up. And so I do think they need to settle on what the decision for the market is going to look like, send that clear signal to the market, stop procuring. They're procuring a lot of extra reserves, probably more than what they need, according to the Independent Market Monitor. All of those things drive prices higher. But I would suggest, I think the biggest input there is the lack of an active demand side and the lack of a focus on reducing energy waste. That is extremely costly.
Doug, a few months back, we went down to Austin and we interviewed Pablo Vegas, who's in charge of the Texas Electric Grid, in charge of ERCOT. And he said one thing that really stuck with me. He said by the end of the decade, Texas will need, daily usage, something like 120,000 megawatts per day. For context, you know this, but for our listeners, I think the peak was, what, 80,000, 85,000 this past summer. That's 6 years away. And he said, you know, listen, the market's going to meet this demand, but, you know, it takes a long time to spin a lot of these things up in 6 years. Will we see higher prices? Can the market meet this? Should I be concerned?
I mean, concerned, perhaps. I do think, though, that we have all the we are close to having all the pieces in place. The technology that is there and the market signals for instance, distributed resources like solar and storage. You think of all the batteries moving around in electric vehicles already. Just the number of vehicles we have on the road today, which is a little over 250,000, there's 16,000 megawatts in those cars, right? Wow. We're going to see a lot more electric vehicles, right? That's kind of amazing, right? So you say we're at 85 and we need 100. Well, there's 16 driving around on four wheels, right? And that's at the very early, early days of electric vehicles. So I listened to that interview, and I you guys did a great job. And I thought he, to his credit, Pablo, who's going to be, there'll be an episode coming out of my podcast called Energy Capital Podcast with Pablo soon. And he is, to his credit, talking a lot about having more demand side resources, more demand flexibility. So if you think of those electric vehicles and you think of what we were just talking about is the sun sets at 6 or 7 o'clock on a summer day, if everybody's plugging in their car and charging at the same time, we could have more grid problems. The inverse is true. If everybody plugs in and there's a smart charging software running, says, hey, prices are real high. Would you like to just charge up at 1 in the morning, right? And then you charge up when power prices are cheap overnight. And you could even potentially power your home with that car, right? You could have a battery to home interface and bring the demand of your home down. Now we're not only alleviating pressure from not charging at the wrong time, we're actually taking that home's load down. So I think that that is going to be a huge part of meeting our need. It's not the only thing. The demand side is one piece of the puzzle. We're going to need a lot more power, solar, storage, wind. We're going to get some more gas. There's already a lot more gas in the queue. Even things like geothermal and nuclear, it's going to take more transmission to connect more resources. We're going to need to do a lot of things right. But I do believe that that is possible. And I believe it's possible with the market structure we have.
We've heard doubt that there's going to be a bunch of new gas generation here. You think that we will see new gas plants being built to handle a big share of that load?
Well, the subsidies that are put in place from Senate Bill 2627 and Proposition 7, which Texas voters voted, you know, favorably for, those are rich subsidies. Those are very rich subsidies. I would be surprised if we don't get some. I mean, it's a 3% loan. Go find 3% money right now, right? That's not easy to do. And then there's $120,000 a megawatt. That's roughly 10 to 15% of the cost of a power plant, plus the low interest money. So I think we're going to see some more gas build. I think what we're going to see, Jason, and you see this, if you look at the interconnection queue, and I'm a nerd, so I look at this every month when it comes out on the first, and 85% of the natural gas in the queue, and there's like 16,000 megawatts in the queue, not all that will get built. They are what are called peaker plants. They're just designed to run a few hundred hours out of the year. And I think that's the kind of gas plant we're going to see come into the market, because that's really what if the system needs gas, that's what it needs. Whatever comes on to the grid, you want to be a flexible resource. You want it to be able to move quickly up and down, right? And this is part of the reason why batteries are so great, because they can not only be dispatched very quickly, but they can also then soak up demand, you know, soak up power when we have a lot of it, right? Mm. So I think those are the kinds of resources we're going to see come onto the grid.
Hey, here's a pro tip for the Yolitics podcast, Doug. You can usually take a swig when Wheeler asks the questions. They're the longest questions in the world. So that's a good time to have a swig. I'm going to stretch mine out for a moment here.
I'm going to take a risk.
Four
okay,
beers
good.
If last
you'll
time.
Stretch yours out. That's good. Okay. I can lean back and drink.
I'll stretch mine out for a moment to let you get that in, since Wheeler had an unusually short question there. But hey, we've already had a handful of warm, hot days so far, and at the end of February, beginning of March here. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about this summer and conservation alerts and kind of where things are headed?
So I think I am optimistic in general about the summer, because I think that the ERCOT grid is much better suited for the summertime. And what I mean by that is all the solar, right? We're up over like 23 gigawatts of solar. That's just a wild thing to say out loud. I didn't imagine, you know, 5-6 years ago, this is where we'd be. We talked about storage earlier. That's going to help a lot with that. What, of course, worries me is the heat and the heat, which is, you know, we are making the planet hotter. And that is a problem. A lot of Texas leaders have a problem talking about this, but as we're recording the largest wildfire in Texas history, I think the second largest in American history, is still burning and only 15% contained. And that is partially happening as the state climatologist, you don't have to take my word for it, there's an official state climatologist, John Nielsen Gammon, and he says, yes, the odds of these things go up when you have these really hot and dry Februaries and Marches, which is the biggest wildfire season up there in the panhandle. So yes, I'm worried about that. I'm worried about, these heat domes like we had last summer. And these are not going to get better. Unfortunately, over the next, 10, 15, 20 years and beyond, they're going to get worse because we continue to emit a lot of greenhouse gases. And so climate change is a very disruptive force. It's something that we're still not having an adult conversation about in Texas. It's time that we do. And as a matter of fact, if Texas political leadership wants to talk about it, they got a great story to tell. We got more wind and solar than California, right? Thumb your nose at them. Tell them we're beating you guys. We're doing better solving climate change than you are. But you've got to acknowledge that it exists and you got to get prepared for it. And so that's what worries me, is that ERCOT continues to model future weather based on past weather. And future weather is not going to be like past weather. So that's what worries me. The winter still worries me more than the summer.
That's a great point. I was just going to ask you about that, because if we were to get another Uri, which was the February 2021 storm here in Texas that, led to those, what they called rolling blackouts. They were blackouts that sat in place, actually, for a lot of people, though, for days. The power consumption would be enormous if that were to happen again, and it may have a terrible outcome for folks again.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, ERCOT published, they sort of put it into a kind of an obscure report that I read a lot of things that come out of ERCOT, and I didn't see this one for a good 3 or 4 weeks after it was published. But they did put some projections of how much demand would be if we had another winter storm Uri. And they said in 2025, obviously next year, we would need 92,000 megawatts of power. And I can tell you right now, if the temperatures are in the single digits and there is snow and ice, we will not have 92,000 megawatts. And the main reason for that is because we would lean heavily on gas, when the gas supply system is still the Achilles heel of the system. We still see drops in gas output. We saw it during Heather. We saw it during Elliott. So winter is still very, very problematic. And it is a problem. Both the winter and the summer problems beg for what I was talking about earlier. They just cry out for this energy waste reduction. That 92,000 megawatt demand, there's two sides of this equation. There's the supply. Will we have enough supply? But there is that demand number itself, and that's driven primarily by inefficient heat in poorly insulated homes. And we've really got to put an emphasis on that.
Hey, my last question, Doug, is about a congressman named Greg Kassar, who introduced a bill, which I'm sure you heard about, a Democrat from Austin. And he has a bill for which, if passed, would require Texas to hook up to the, quote, national grid, the Eastern Interconnect and Western Interconnect. Pablo Vegas, the CEO of ERCOT, says, listen, the amount of money it's going to take to do that would be better spent just on reinforcing what we have here in Texas, more transmission lines, et cetera. What do you think is the best way to go?
Yeah, he actually addressed this on the podcast we recorded, and what he emphasized to me was that what he really meant to say was, and what he thought he said was, we need to study this. We really need to understand if that investment and that amount of money is better than other alternatives. And he said, I don't actually know. So that's kind of interesting. But my view of this is, I think we ought to take this in steps. I think it ought to be a crawl, walk, run. And I should preface this by saying, I'm appreciative that Congressman Kassar and the other members of Congress that put that bill forward are trying to do something proactive. And I do think we need more transmission. And I do think we need interconnections to East and West. The question is the approach they took with this sort of, I think it was like 40 or 50 gigawatts of interconnection, which then means now you're completely a national grid and there's federal regulation. Is that the right way to go? I would rather see a crawl, walk, run, that being the run, And the crawl would be, or even walk, would be connect Texas through these interconnections that are that have been proposed. So there's a project called Southern Spirit, which would put 3 gigawatts of connection. Again, as I said earlier, right, 3.5 gigawatts is Austin's peak load. That's not a small amount of power. That would triple the amount of interconnections with renewables to the Southeast that once the governments of Texas paid for by the citizens. If there were to be a grid emergency, we could reverse flow and bring power back in from our neighbors to the Southeast. So there's another one proposed to connect to El Paso and out to the West, and that's about 1.5 gigawatts. So I think we ought to prioritize those. Those are projects that ratepayers, you know, to Pablo Vegas's concern, is the cost worth it? Those are merchant transmission lines. Those are not being charged to us. So that's the investor risk. I think that's the way to go. Let's get those done. Keep ERCOT's independence while we study that issue. I still think there are advantages to not having to ask FERC for just about anything you'd have to do.
And FERC, of course, is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is the overseer. If you're on the national grid, go ahead, Wheeler.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Ed Herr is the energy fellow at the University of Houston, has been critical of that plan too, saying he doesn't think it would help in time and that some of those other grids might actually be weaker than the one we have here. But since we bring up FERC, I do want to ask you, I have two more questions because I always have more questions than Whiteley does. You talked about
Wheeler likes to hear himself talk a lot, but go ahead, Wheeler. Let's listen to you talk for a minute. Go ahead.
I have no idea what that's like. What is it like to want to hear yourself? My family makes fun of me all the time. They're like, you're so loud. You listen to yourself?
Here's the weird thing is that I'm going to be talking, but I'm going to be saying Doug's words. Watch this. So we're talking about ERCOT, the state regulator here. And it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence when I read one of your tweets about them. And I just thought this was really interesting. You were talking about their meetings of the board there at ERCOT. You said they feel like what you imagine Soviet meetings were like, with little discussion, perfunctory reports, and quick, unanimous, unquestioning approvals of all motions. This is not how a grid supporting the 8th largest economy in the world should be governed.
Yeah. Yeah. That meeting, the ERCOT board meeting, lasted all of 1 hour. They had a lot of weighty issues before them. You know, I mean, they always have a lot of their, and they're paid, right? These are part-time board positions that are $160,000. You know, they show up 6 times a year. They have their subcommittee meetings, but they meet as a full board for an hour. They did not hear a presentation from the independent market monitor. I mean, how do you pay for a position? All of us pay for the independent market monitor, and the full board doesn't think it's worth their time. Their job is to make sure there's not the IMM, the independent market monitor, make sure there's not market manipulation and there's an efficient market for our economy. They didn't think it was worth their time to hear a report. I don't think this is talked about nearly enough. The ERCOT board was changed in a major way under Senate Bill 2. Senate Bill 2, there were hearings on Senate Bill 2. There was a lot of input taken in amendments. And on the Friday before the session ended on a Monday, the 137th day of a 140-day session, they did a motion. The Senate had a motion, and then the House followed up with a motion to go outside the bounds, which means you can completely jettison the bill and start over. And they introduced a brand new thing. I mean, there's very little that unites ERCOT stakeholders, but you ask anybody involved in ERCOT, kind of, is it better now the way it is after SB2 than before? It's pretty darn unanimous. It's a very strange dynamic over there. Look, I think just at the end of the day, we need a board that is going to ask questions that they really didn't ask any questions last time. I'll give you just one more example. Sorry to you've got me animated, and I've got half a beard.
They should hear Wheeler's questions. He has a lot of them, though. Go ahead, though, Doug.
I know. Well, maybe they'll come on and talk to you. I think that would be great, because I think they need to explain their positions more. That board unanimously approved an NPRR. That's a protocol revision request. So that's like a rule change at ERCOT that would have really slowed down batteries coming into the market. It was NPRR 1186 was the name of it. They unanimously approved it. And then the PUC, and I give the PUC a ton of credit for this, the PUC studied this, they asked really tough questions, and then they unanimously reversed it and said, no, you can't. They were told by the legislature, PUC, you got to oversee everything coming out of ERCOT. They took that responsibility seriously. And they said, we are not going to slow down dispatchable, flexible resources that are coming into our market to make the grid more reliable. And it just begs the question, how did not one ERCOT board member stop and say, does this make sense?
And the PUC you're referring to there is the Public Utility Commission, which oversees ERCOT. I probably wouldn't do well on the ERCOT board then because I have so many questions that I like to ask.
Those meetings would go longer than an hour, I'll tell you that. They go a hell of a lot longer than an hour. But go ahead, Wheeler.
I would encourage everybody to bring a beer to that meeting. my last question, and I'll stick with just one more. I want to know what your thoughts are about the 2025 legislative session, which starts this coming January. The last one, I mean, straight out of the gates, man. It looked like wind and solar had some major targets on them. There were a lot of bills that were not wind and solar or battery friendly. Are you expecting another round like that? And I guess how closely are you watching these primary elections right now to see, you know, what you might expect?
Yeah, look, I don't think there's any doubt there will be more attacks on renewables. I think they're very misguided, and they come from, again, a lot of times these things get painted as oil and gas versus renewables, as we talked about earlier. You know, many in the oil and gas industry, particularly larger oil and gas companies, want to purchase renewables. So these are coming out of more of an ideological place than it is from a business place. And my hope is that those proposals will be defeated again, because sort of cooler heads will prevail, and those that understand that the future of this state is tied to having more energy resources, not less, and that Texas really can be an energy leader, that those voices will win out. Obviously, as with every issue in front of the state, you know, elections matter. I guess this probably won't come out till after the election, or I'd do the public service announcement and say, go vote, because what are we like, 3 or 4% or something, just right. I don't know. You guys know exactly what the number is. Something like that.
It's bad, been like 5-6% in recent years for each primary.
Yeah, and I think it's even lower this year, tracking lower. So, you know, the outcomes of these elections matter for energy and climate issues, and they matter for every other issue. So absolutely, whatever happens in the primaries on Tuesday will absolutely impact those discussions and outcomes during the session, no doubt.
Doug, always insightful, man. I love your Twitter feed or your X feed as well, because every time like we post something, I'm like, all right, let's see if Doug corrects us on this. Let's see if we're within the bounds of where we should be on this energy talk. So people can follow that. You're at Doug Lewin Energy if they want to find you on X, on Twitter. And of course, you're the president of Stoic Energy and the host of the Energy Capital podcast. Dude, great insight as always. Thanks for that. And bring us a Jester King next time.
You got it, man. When next time you're in Austin, hit me up. We'll go down to Jester King and drink a few down there.
That is an invitation we cannot refuse. Doug, thanks so much for doing this with us again. We really appreciate it.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV and watch the latest episode of Y'allitics each Wednesday night at 8:30.